in a way, we're happy when they're relaxed using media and they're not in our face, so to speak. But I think we really have to be aware of that because there is a lot of violence and it's repetitive in the media. And if you have a boy who plays 6 hours of World of Warcraft every night, you know, you've got a problem there, even though you're having a wonderful family dinner hour.
Well, yeah, I think it is sometimes harder to do it here because we have a way of life that is more disciplined, I'd say, as Orthodox Christians. And so if we want to be faithful observers of that way of life, it can be harder. Sometimes you can look a little funny doing it. So that requires us to be conscious of it. It also requires us to be intentional, both in our lifestyles as well as our efforts at living it out and learning about it and being aware of it.
Dr. Tony Vrame talking about what makes an Orthodox Christian and, Orthodox Christian, I suppose, and part two of Dr. Lynn Ponton discussing children and violence from all angles. Welcome to another edition of Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network with our host, Father Christopher Metropoulos, the founder of this ministry and the president of Hellenic College and Holy Cross Orthodox School of Theology in Brookline, Massachusetts. And I'm Mike Trout. We're on the web at myocn.net and also on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Dr. Lynn Ponton is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and a professor at the University of California in San Francisco. She is also an author and a frequent guest on media of all kinds, and she joined Father Chris by phone for a lengthy conversation about the ever-increasing concern over children and the influence of the violent world which surrounds them. We shared part one last week of that conversation, and you can listen to that when you go to the website, myocn.net, and select the Listen button on the homepage, and then Come Receive the Light, or CRTL. And now here's the second half of that interview.
You know, violent behavior is learned. People, you know, they learn it. It's inside all of us, of course. We all have impulses, you know, that are violent, but we learn the behavior. We don't act on them necessarily. And children aren't inherently more violent than adults, you know, so they really do learn from TV, from media, from watching people, from getting bullied at school. All of those are ways to learn about this. So I think, you know, being aware of that, that it's a learned behavior, indicates how important it is to get some other type of conversations going, other ways of addressing a bullying child's behavior. It's really key that the parents intervene.
And I've also seen, and you can please correct me if I'm wrong here, that when we deal with parents many times and they're dealing with their children, they're coming from a position of weakness, not a position of strength and knowledge and confidence as a parent. So they go back into that friend mode rather than a parent mode. And most of the kids that I dealt with and that I have dealt with in the past 30 plus years of ministry really want a parent. They don't want a friend. They got enough friends.
We hope they have enough friends,
hope, right?
Father. But I agree with you. And having raised four kids, you know, we are not their friends. Mm-hmm. You know, I think my two daughters at this point, one just married, she's 29. She'd say mom is my best friend. Mm-hmm. But that was 29 years in the process.
Right.
You know, and she was not my friend for a lot of years. I sure was.
I got that. I hear you.
We were not friends.
I hear you.
But I think that process of recognizing that you help your children more, not by being a friend, but by being a parent and trying to look down the road ahead for them and see where they're going to have their struggles and then intervene and help them in those areas. And that's sometimes painful because you don't want to believe that they're doing these terrible things. It's scary.
It is scary. Let's go over, Doctor, if you could, some of the, obviously it's easier to stop bad behavior before it starts. So we have to look at some of those red flags that indicate that violent or bad behavior might be coming. You've mentioned some of them, but let's tick off a few of them for some of the parents that might be listening right now.
Well, I think things to look at, you know, we talked about starting in the home, looking at how they treat their siblings, looking at violence towards self. If you are suspicious that they are self-cutting or mutilating or bruising themselves, if when they have a disappointment they pound their fist up against the wall, you want to pay attention to all of this. And you, Father, already mentioned models for violent behavior in the home. If there's a, you know, an aunt, an uncle, a parent who's demonstrating aggressive behavior in the home, you have to work especially hard with that. Meaning you have to get that person help, you have to point out the impact of this on your child, and that involves even an extra layer. And I think many good-hearted, caring parents are working against these, you know, violent elements in their family home. And that requires being tough and aggressive and saying, maybe my children and I are going to have to move and live in a smaller setting. You know, because we've got to get away from this. So that starts just in the home addressing violence. Then I think the second factor that's most important in the home is being aware of what your child is doing with the media. Even though we're exhausted, especially moms, from working all day and cooking the meals and doing everything, that in a way we're happy when they're relaxed using media and they're not in our face, so to speak. But I think we really have to be aware of that because there is a lot of violence and it's repetitive in the media. And if you have a boy who plays 6 hours of World of Warcraft every night, you know, you've got a problem there, even though you're having a wonderful family dinner hour. So that's the home setting. And then I would say talk to the school, find out if your child's in a violent school. Or faces violence walking to and from school. All of those things have to be addressed. And then I think the most important thing is having conversations with your child, getting them involved in healthy risk-taking, which can be sports or working on a news station, volunteer, or all kinds of creative activities. So healthy risk-taking is protective against the dangerous and violent behavior.
Dr. Ponden, let's look for a moment at the issue of bullying at school. And that, of course, is a big issue today. We hear it both for the young boys, the young girls. We're talking a little bit more here about young girls, but why don't you address it in both steps? What are some of the steps that they should take if they are being bullied or they witness bullying?
Well, I think first to realize that bullying in communities and schools where children grow up is everyone's problem. It's not just the child who's being bullied or even the bullied child. So the solutions really lie in committed, you know, parents, teachers, and the children themselves working as a team. So let's say I'm working with a teenager, and they describe, as they often do, bullying actions which have occurred at their high school that day. This mm-hmm. happens all the time.
Yes.
And then, you know, how do we marshal efforts and really address that behavior? You know, first I'll have a conversation with the teenager. Let's say they're being bullied. Then I'll suggest that the parent come in the room. We all work together. Then we make a kind of action plan about what we should do with the school around this behavior. And say 20 years ago, I may not have encouraged the parents to immediately contact the school. But often today I find that the behaviors are progressive. And if you don't address them immediately, it can get worse very quickly. So I think it's important to really get the child involved in the process if they don't feel confident. Either I or the parent can do it. Because I often talk to the schools and, you know, explain some of what's being reported and work with schools on bullying prevention programs, mm-hmm. which are really, really important. Now, if the child is identified as the bully, often you got another situation there. And this, here I think you're correct, Father. I think many parents of bullying children do not see that their children are engaged in these very unhealthy behaviors.
Not my
child. They're often sent to me by the police or the school, and they don't want to be there, and they want me to kind of say that their child's behavior is normal.
Wow.
So, you know, then I have to educate them, you know, about what it might be like if their child is arrested at 17 for sexting naked pictures of boys and girls in the high school.
Yes.
And what would be involved with that. And, you know, and I even have them talk to some parents who've gone through the process of having a bullying child.
It's interesting. I have a couple more things I'd just like to ask
sure,
if you don't mind.
For Father Chris,
Let's talk briefly about girls and sexual violence. What's going on with young women, the sexual abuse of them, the violence? What can we as parents do to reduce the chances that our daughter
first,
might be sexually abused?
Just to say something about sexual abuse of teenagers.
Okay.
20% of all young, you know, or 20% of all boys are sexually abused as
20%.
Boys or adolescents. That's high. I want you to know that because I think a lot of times boys are ashamed to come forward and tell what has happened to them. They're often then untreated, and, you know, there is risk, I think, you know, with untreated sexual abuse, particularly with boys, that they can also then abuse others at some point in time. And that's not to say that all boys who've been sexually abused abuse others, because I actually did a study that showed that most of them don't. But I think it's important for parents to think, you know, what is that relationship that that older man or middle-aged man or young man has with my son? You know, what's going on there? It's important to think that, you know, and to question that. With girls, sexual abuse runs generally, is considered to run about a third of all girls or adolescent girls are sexually abused in that childhood period. So again, and this has been a problem for, since we started getting the statistics, so probably 30, 40 years. So knowing this, as a parent, you're going to really question, you know, where, you know, relationships that people have with your children. Mm-hmm. Now, what are the risky areas? I think what shocks most parents is that most children know their abusers. So it is somebody in the context of the family or the community setting. So I think to be aware of that. The second, and just say it up front, many of those who engage in sexual abuse against children are warm, engaging, wonderful members of the community and can fool others, really. And I've been involved with, I would say, hundreds of these situations, and I've been fooled, too, by people. Mm-hmm. So I think to be aware of that and to, you know, you think you will know what a pedophile looks like, feels like, sounds like, and that's not the case. And children don't know. So I think we have to educate our children some. You know, the Safe Touch programs do that. But I think it's even important to talk to children, especially as they get to be 11, 12, and 13, and to alert them to the fact that, you know, older individuals will try to touch them in ways that are not healthy for them. You know, and it's an important education. It's a process. The other thing I think we have to do is treat, you know, boys who engage in sexual abuse and girls, you know, in their adolescence so they don't go on to, you know, have that problem throughout their life. And those treatment programs are available. You know, they do make a difference with children who've engaged in these behaviors, and they're really important to get your child into if your child's been, you know, accused of this behavior.
I guess that's for another program, but I would, as a pastor, I'm thinking, and as a parent, I'm trying to think, what is it that causes someone to do this to a child? And we'll have to answer that. We'll have to have you on the program again, because I'm sure that's for another program and a lot longer that's going to take to deal with. Let me go to this question. You recently wrote the preface to a book called Killing Monsters, Why Children Need Fantasy, Superheroes, and Make-Believe Violence.
Yes.
Children need violent stories? Why is that?
Well,
do you think?
The key word there is make-believe violence.
There you go. Okay.
And I think, again, you know, violence is part of our inner world, our inner landscape for all of us. You know, let's say we're in a car and somebody cuts us off, another driver. And we may think, boy, I should really slow down because that was a near miss. But we may also think, that's a crazy driver. I'd like to hit him or get him off the road. And it's a passing or fleeting thought, but it is, you know, part of the violence spectrum. So I think kids need to hear about how we deal with our violent thoughts, fantasies, and impulses. And as I mentioned earlier, I think the ancient myths, you know, talks so much about violence because they're trying to educate people about violence.
Well, Doctor, I want to thank you very much for being on the program today.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, well, thank my assistant, Tamuna. She's your fan.
And I thank your assistant as well. God bless you and be with you in all the days of your life, and I hope we'll speak again soon.
Okay, thank you, Father Chris.
Thank you so
Take
much.
Care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Again, that was Dr. Lynn Ponton, a child and adolescent psychiatrist and a professor at the University of California in San Francisco. And her last words there made me think about you and the listening audience. You might have someone on your mind, an acquaintance, someone you've come across in your reading or viewing or listening, whom you think we should interview. Well, send that along to us. You can reach us when you go to the website, myocn.net. That's myocn.net, or through Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. This is an outreach of the Orthodox Christian Network, a broadcast called Come Receive the Light, and we're a nonprofit ministry. That means we depend upon your support. If you'd like to become a team member with us, when you go to the website, check out the Donate button. There are a number of ways in which you can participate with us on a one-time basis or an ongoing basis. That's myocn.net. And now with our feature conversation, again, with an emphasis on children, here's Father Chris.
In a multicultural society like the USA, especially where there are so many communities, many of our youth struggle to find the words to describe the Orthodox faith to their friends. With us today to answer the question, what is Orthodoxy, is Dr. Anton Vrain, the Director of the Department of Religious Education of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of North America. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you for having me, Father.
Well, that first question, what is Orthodoxy? As the Director of Religious Education, I can't imagine you haven't been asked that question. So let's pose it and see what you can tell us.
Yeah, it's a presentation I've given a few times, born out of the struggle we often have when we have to explain ourselves to others. And so I've tried to think about that in a way that's positive, engaging, and can foster the conversation with our non-Orthodox friends, family members, and people that we meet on the street. Sometimes people think of it as the elevator speech, but I think my answer is a little longer than an elevator speech.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, the easiest answer that I've always heard is to compare Orthodoxy to the Roman Catholic Church. We always say, we're like the Catholic Church, but our priests marry.
Yeah, that's commonly done.
Commonly done, right? And
yeah.
It's because we're liturgical, remember the saints. It's not a very good answer, though, is it? What do you think?
No, I don't think it's a good answer, because first it starts by starting with our differences, one, and the reference is the Roman Catholic Church, rather than starting from within ourselves as Orthodox. And then when you start to take it a little bit further, people start naming external things to what makes us Orthodox. So, you know, Father, you're a clergyman. If you didn't wear your vestments, would you still be a priest?
Of course, sure.
Of course you would be. So can we move to something beyond that external reality, to something deeper to explain who we are to others?
Is that partially our fault because we haven't given this information to our people? I mean, that's one of the reasons we're doing this interview today, is to give people sort of that ammo that they need.
Yeah.
Not that it's a fight, but it's a conversation that's happening.
Yeah, I think sometimes it is. When you're a small community like we are, we often have to explain ourselves to something that people know about, and so you kind of go from there. You start with what people experience when they encounter an Orthodox church. So they experience vestments and icons and incense and different kinds of music and things like that. So we do those kinds of things because those are the first experiences. But again, is that what really makes us Orthodox? What would happen if those things were not available to us?
Okay, let's go into that then. So what happens when we remove those external elements? What do we have?
Well, what do we got? What I've been able to do, and I've been thinking about this for a long time, is I think we can hang, to put an unglamorous term on it, our tradition on seven key points. And I'll quickly run through them, and this will be the longest piece of the whole part, our conversation, but stop me if something doesn't make sense to you. First, we're Christians. We often have to explain to people that we are Christians. And while that doesn't may not sound all that remarkable, the fact that we're Orthodox, our Christianity, is our understanding of who Jesus Christ is, and that points to our understandings from Scripture, the ecumenical councils, the fact that we experience Christ in the liturgy and in Holy Communion. But it's first and foremost about Christ. It's not about ecumenical councils per se. And so when Christ posed the question of who do you say that I am to his disciples, I as an Orthodox can say, well, you are the Christ that I experience in the liturgy and understand through Scripture and the tradition of the seven councils. So that's point one. The second point is we are a church. We can't do this alone. We are a radically communal religion. And that really makes us somewhat different than especially Protestant communities in the United States, which have a long tradition of saying it's all about me and Jesus. We say it's all about me and Jesus that I find in the church. And so we need one another to be Christians. And there, again, the councils are a good example of that. The sacraments are good examples of why we are church. The third point is we have a very positive view of human life. Our understanding of saints and salvation, theosis, all this theology around us says that people are fundamentally positive human beings and are meant to be good, fallen and in need of salvation and in need of sanctification, but still fundamentally good. And again, this points a difference in some Christian theologies that see human life as terrible beings incapable of positive salvation. The fourth, we have, again, on this positive front, we have a positive view of the world. We're not dualists. We don't think the material world is a bad place. You think about how we use it in our liturgical life, especially flowers and bread. All of these kinds of things point to that reality of the world around us being a fundamentally good place, and we are here to care for it. And you think of our environmental ethos, especially that's given to us through the ecumenical patriarch these last few decades, leading us to think in an environmental way, but it's rooted in who we are. It's not something outside of us. The fifth one is, I think about it as time. We think about time very creatively. Every day is dedicated to reflecting on him. Our day itself is divided into parts through the liturgical life. But what I find so interesting is that we also think about seasons, that we have periods of the year where we're dedicating our attention to the Nativity of Christ, the Virgin Mary in August, the Apostles in June, and of course the resurrection, the Passion and the Resurrection in Great Lent. Mm-hmm. And we also mark time in people's lives. We, with the sacraments of baptism, marriage, even funerals, are about passages in our life cycle. Sixth, we're here to serve the world. We are here for the life of the world. And we continue Christ's ministry of healing and reconciliation. And that's through our philanthropy, our social service, our social advocacy. And we're called to be that agent of Christ, his hands in today's world. And the last one is that wherever we go, I call it everywhere present and filling all things, wherever the Orthodox Church goes, we pick up the stuff of the society, the culture, the time that we live in, and bring it within our church. And through that, we find a new way to express it in a culturally contemporary, appropriate time. So that explains why there's a Greek Orthodoxy that looks differently from a Russian Orthodoxy. And a very concrete example is our church architecture, our church music. And so because we have this principle at work, we're able to find continually new and renewed ways of expressing our Orthodox faith to the place and time that we find ourselves. So it's these seven things, and you can, you know, they overlap at times, but they, each one of them points to something deeper about who we are and explains, I think, what makes us Orthodox.
No, those are excellent. All seven of them really draw in on our theology and the basis really of who we are, and are an apology to the greater good. There's no doubt about it. I mean, but I would imagine this conversation is going to be a little bit different in an Orthodox country. Do you think it's harder to be an Orthodox Christian in a non-Orthodox country? Or is it something that's the challenge that we're up for? I wonder sometimes whether our people get overwhelmed and they say, I just can't do this. I can't live like this because the rest of the world's going in a completely different direction.
Well, yeah, I think it is sometimes harder to do it here because we have a way of life that is more disciplined, I'd say, as Orthodox Christians. The fact that we, again, they think of the liturgical year and what it asks of us. And so if we want to be faithful observers of that way of life, it can be harder. We don't have the same level of cultural support within the greater society to practice it. And sometimes you can look a little funny doing it. So that requires us to be conscious of it. It also requires us to be intentional, both in our lifestyles as well as our efforts at living it out and learning about it and being aware of it.
Tony, I'd like to ask you to speak more on how, because we did intimate this a little bit, but how does faith permeate the culture for those who think they have to be, let's say, a Greek, a Romanian, a Russian to be Orthodox? How do you explain the separation of that ethnic identity with the Orthodox faith?
In some ways you can't, because all religions have to take on some form of concrete expression. And that concrete expression is culturally determined and affected. And those of us that travel internationally as Orthodox Christians, I think, come across that we realize that I, as a Greek Orthodox American Orthodox, you know, Greek Orthodox American Christian, I kind of do it differently. I live it differently than when I go to Greece, and it is expressed differently. Our Orthodox Christianity here in the United States has been infused with certain ideas of American society. And so you can't separate them out. And so I sometimes want to remind people that they're being American and Orthodox is a cultural expression of our faith. And we don't see it because we're in the middle of it. We're living it. But it's until we step outside of the United States and go to Greece or Russia or places like that, we realize that we do live this differently than they do over there, because of how we as Orthodox Christians living our lives in the United States have appropriated ideas from the society around us, good ones like democracy or freedom of choice and freedom of expression, that you don't find in other ways of expressing it and in the way our church lives. So we don't think of our American identity as an ethnicity, but it is. And it is being infused into Orthodox Christianity. It's messy because we're in the middle of it. It swings back and forth because we're always wrestling, what does it mean to be Orthodox in this culture? But we're living through it, and it is different. And there is an ethnicity, an ethnic American Orthodox church.
Very good, Tony. Just one last question. Can you tell us how an internet ministry like OCN plays a role in the modern expression of faith?
One, it's communicating it. It's talking about it. And it's raising these issues for people wherever they find themselves to wrestle with it. And, you know, I would hope that people, it's encouraging them not just to say, oh, that's a very nice presentation that I just heard, but to explore more deeply to go to their local parishes and to see what's going on there. And so it's that vehicle, I think, that can be A, broadcasting who we are to others, but also the hook, as it were, that brings them closer in and then encouraging them to develop what they know about it. I mean, even I think my own presentation, the way I'm presenting it, is challenging us to think more consciously about who we are. And to do that, you've got to engage the church, the sources, the tradition itself, and a ministry like yours, and the various ways we can engage with those, is critical.
Very good. Thank you, Tony. Thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And thank you to those of you in the listening audience as well for sharing your precious time with us. This is Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network. I'm Mike Trout, and our host is Father Christopher Metropoulos, the president of Hellenic College and Holy Cross Greek Orthodox School of Theology in Brookline, Massachusetts. You can learn more about us on the web at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. And to listen to other conversations with Dr. Vrame, or to hear part one of the interview with Dr. Lynn Ponton, again, go to the website and click on the Listen button on the homepage, and then select Come Receive the Light. Have a great rest of your week. We'll be back next week with another broadcast, and I hope you can join us. In the meantime, remember to always have faith in what you listen to.